Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today, we're going to bring you some intriguing information. I want to talk about Marilyn Monroe. Yes, I want to talk about Marilyn Monroe and all the Marilyn Monroes in the world. All the people who are overwhelmed by their emotional selves and their sense of attachments. Marilyn Monroe, you know, you ever, why were so many people intrigued and what happened to her? Well, the program's not about Marilyn Monroe, but it's about people of this high-level emotionality. And it's called, well, let me ask my guest what it's called. My guest is Dr. Frank Yeomans. Dr. Frank Yeomans is with New York Presbyterian Hospital Cornell Medical Center, hereinafter called New York Medical Center, New York Cornell, who's with us today, and he's a specialist in dealing with this highly emotional state. Frank, what would be welcome to the station, number one.
Welcome to
WBAI. And what did Marilyn Monroe, I mean, Marilyn Monroe, would she be alive today, possibly, if she had gotten the proper treatment?
Well, I'll have to give you two answers to that question. First of all, any good therapist can't diagnose someone they haven't evaluated themselves, so any diagnosis is conjectural. But in terms of the high emotionality you're talking about and the impulsive self-destructive behaviors, we might be talking about the condition we call borderline personality disorder. Would she be alive today? Or if she were alive today, would she have a better chance of not taking the overdose if it was an overdose? I'd say certainly if she were alive today, she'd have a much better chance of getting good treatment. There are specialized treatments today for this disorder which did not exist back in the 60s.
Back in the 60s, Marilyn Monroe was a nuisance to many people. Whether she died because the world was hostile towards her and they didn't understand her, or whether she died because somebody actually planned her death, you know, either one is possible. The main thing we know is that had she had a psychiatrist around who, instead of giving her medications, had given her, you know, the medications they gave her, mm-hmm. which were mood stabilizers and antidepressants and sleeping pills.
Well, mostly sleeping pills and downers, yeah.
And downers. Instead of that, if they'd given her the proper medication and the treatment, she, having been embraced by someone like Dr. Frank Yeomans, would have maybe with us today. You know, she may be around here today doing all kinds of good things. But back then, in 1962, no one understood this stuff. So since then, in these past 40 years, we've made quite a few gains. And Dr. Yeomans is with us today to help explain to us what this condition is called, the one called borderline personality disorder. I'd like you to understand it, because wherever you see in very high, intense emotionality, there's a suspicion. You know, if somebody is very, very emotional and it's something that's there on a regular basis, not just once in a while, you suspect some kind of an emotional, some kind of a psychiatric bent. You know, so would you describe it to us? What under what condition?
Well, I'll describe it to you the way I would describe it to a patient I was seeing who I thought might have this condition. And I think basically we can break it down into four areas of difficulty, because it's a whole syndrome. The first area of difficulty that you've emphasized is the emotional area. The person goes through life as though they're on an emotional roller coaster. It's all highs, lows, very little middle ground. Things are experienced in the extreme, and this gets to be really exhausting, and it also can be exhausting for those around the individual who are dealing with them. So the emotional disorder is very primary. Secondly, and no doubt related to this, are disorders of relationships. Relationships tend to be very chaotic and stormy and passionate and extreme anger, extreme love. So there's very little in the way of stable relationships in someone suffering from this disorder. Then the third area of problem are behavioral difficulties. Behaviors, things that people do that cause trouble. And this is what the condition is most known for, because the most dramatic manifestation are impulsive self-destructive actions, particularly impulsive wrist-cutting, impulsive overdosing. A little less dramatic and a little more common, but often related, is also substance abuse and sexual promiscuity as forms of self-destructive behavior. But if you take those three things, I think we can look at another factor which really underlies and leads to them all, and that's the lack of a clear sense of self. Going through life not knowing who you are, not having a sense of your goals, your beliefs, your values, your interests. Life is totally confusing to you. Relationships are unreliable. And in this state of confusion, emotions reign supreme.
There's someone I know who might qualify for the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder was called by her family a force of nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very accurate thing, because it feels like a force of nature. You feel like a typhoon. You feel like a wind. Mm-hmm. And the reaction that people have to you is as if you are a destructive force of nature. People are afraid of you. I mean, eventually, if you get to know somebody with borderline personality disorder, don't you get afraid of them?
I think it depends on the type of borderline. That certainly can be the case. Maybe later we'll have time to talk about different subtypes. But in terms of the classical borderline, it can be overwhelming for those involved. And as you mentioned in passing about Marilyn, she was, I think you used the word, a nuisance to others. And because of that, there's developed a stigma around this diagnosis, which is very unfortunate, because even if those around the individual may suffer, you can bet the individual, him or herself, suffers more. But there is a sense of an emotional force people don't know what to do with. People don't quite understand how to deal with the intensity and what can seem the irrationality, the impulsivity. So usually families are left kind of holding their hands up, not knowing what to do. And there are resources for that we can talk about.
Well, you know, as well as families, Frank, I know enough. I know you're a psychiatrist and you treat this. So the beauty of you and the work you do is, if you see somebody coming in who's in an emotional whirlwind, you can embrace that. You could understand the emotion. But I know many therapists who refuse to treat somebody who has any sense of violence about them, including violence with themselves, violence with their emotions, if they have high emotion. I know therapists who refuse to talk to patients who will raise their voice because they're worried about the neighbors hearing it.
Well, I know therapists like that, too, and it's certainly better if they don't treat them if they're not comfortable. I think there's a more problematic category of therapists are the ones who offer to treat them without the special skills. I never fully understood the phrase, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions," until I saw well-meaning therapists without the special training needed trying to treat borderline patients, because they offer a lot. It usually goes awry. Terrible things happen. It's a catastrophe, all with good intentions. You need special training to treat this population. And if there are people out in the audience who might think they have this, the first recommendation I can give is to look for someone who has some specialty training. But you're right, a lot of therapists don't really know what to do. Some will admit it, some won't. But I would add,
well, you know, I want to say, and just to go with that for a minute, part of the reason the therapists don't know what to do is because therapists are humans.
Yeah.
And very often a person becomes a therapist because they want to distance themselves from the emotions of people by becoming the master of it. You know, that's part of the reason you become a therapist in the first place. I can distance myself from the emotion, you know. And so when somebody comes in who's uncontrollable, they don't like it.
Well, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of becoming a therapist as distancing oneself from emotions. My sense is to get into it more and to master it at the same time.
Okay, so mastery is a form of distancing.
Perhaps,
yourself.
But I would say still mastery with proximity to the
emotions.
Oh,
you and I should have a beer.
I love it.
We need to talk about this one. This is great.
But you see, with these patients, a good therapist welcomes the intensity, and that's not easy to do. You need the special training. You need the special circumstances.
And you need to not have rooms where you're afraid of the soundproofing. I've seen therapists in little cubicles who are afraid to let if the patient raises their voice. Mm-hmm. You know, they say you have to keep your voice down because it disturbs other therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difficulty. We built soundproof rooms here for that very reason, so a person could be free to at least, if they have the emotion, to feel the emotion, at least in our presence.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like a free-for-all when I say we invite the emotional intensity. There do have to be certain conditions. And also, in spite of a widespread belief, my experience as a clinician, having treated many, many, many of these patients, is that they do have some degree of self-control that they might not know about because they never sought to, nobody ever expected it of them, basically. So there are rules like you can express anything you want in my office. You can talk as loud as you want, as intensely as you want. But if my neighbor, if my therapist in the next office starts complaining that it's interfering with his work, then we've got to tone it down.
Interesting. My guest is Dr. Frank Yeomans with New York Cornell Medical Center. This is Armand DeMille here with you with the Positive Mind. We're talking about emotionality, and we're talking about one of the deepest, most destructive to oneself, not destructive to other people. Well, that gets included in here. We're going to have to talk about that as well. But it's a condition, and it's a condition that's misunderstood. You've heard us talk recently about a thing called bipolar disorder. In a manic phase where you have a certain kind of emotionality, this condition, the borderline personality disorder, is the one that is probably the most tormenting. The most tormented of people, because they are tormented, most tormented in this condition, is the nature of the relationships. You see, with the other people, relationships are relationships, but to the borderline personality, a relationship is life itself. Can we talk about that?
It's crucial. A relationship is life itself, and a relationship can be very threatening at the same time. So people with this disorder, their whole life can be a matter of trying to sort out relationships and not successfully doing so. There's a sense of black and whiteness in their perceptions. Somebody's either all good or all bad. They themselves, from one moment to the next, are all good or all bad. So if you perceive reality like that, you can imagine that your emotional reactions will go from one extreme to the next. So the person you loved at one moment, they disappoint you, they frustrate you. You might hate them the next moment. And this is, it's not like you or I who would think, oh, they disappointed me in this instance, but I still love them for all their good qualities. It's rather, they disappointed me, they hate me, and they don't want to have anything to do with me, and I hate them back, and it's over. So that kind of immediate reaction to a small trigger event leads to a lot of this emotional chaos.
All right, let me take that one back a little. The person who is in a relationship, the person who has got this condition, which we call BPD, borderline personality disorder, is in a relationship. The relationship is almost, remember, there's no sense of self. So self becomes me and you. Mm-hmm. It becomes me in the relationship. So now I and you together, I could feel self. And very often they'll choose people mm-hmm. who've got some kind of a dramatic presentation of self. Right? They'll pick somebody who looks very strong or looks very certain way.
Sure, they may be subject to falling into a cult, for example.
Yes. Okay, so they attach themselves. Mm-hmm. And now they're attached, but they're attached in such a way, if they're disappointed, it's like their whole life is falling down the tubes. It's not like you're just losing a relationship. It's not like you're just breaking up with your boyfriend. It's not like you're disappointed by your love. It's your entire life. And the desperation that you feel and you hear, and some of you have gone through this, and some of you have friends who go through this repeatedly, it really feels like your insides are being torn apart, as if you're being torn in different directions with hands grappling at your heart, ripping it to pieces. It's a horrible, horrible feeling when your relationship is threatened if you're a borderline, because on the other side of this, the beauty of it is the kind of love that you have is total.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolute. When you love somebody and you're borderline, you love them completely, absolutely. You get more love. If somebody wants to have good sex, they find a borderline and they have the best sex because it's unlimited, it's fantastic, it's glorious. But then you got to pay your dues, because when things get negative or you try to leave, that person is going to be so, so angry. Let's talk about fatal attraction.
I'd be happy to talk about fatal attraction because I think it's created a lot of misperceptions. But can I offer you a clinical example?
Sure.
So we'll go from the real to the more fantastic. When you were talking about the intensity of the love and the passion, and of course, love and sex may or may not go together, but let's just talk about love and passion for the moment. One of my patients was an extremely intense woman, and she loved passionately, but she also hated passionately. She, at one point, intentionally drove her car into her husband's car because she was angry about this, that, or the other thing. But it was the same man she loved passionately. After 2.5 or 3 years of treatment, she came into a session and said, "You know, you've helped me a lot. I don't do those terrible things I used to do. I don't try to kill myself. I don't beat up my husband. But you've also taken something away from me." She said, "Before this therapy, I used to think in a total, pure, complete, absolute love. And now I've come to realize that doesn't exist."
Yeah.
It's kind of growing up in a way.
It's growing up, but, you know, it's growing up from what you could feel. Just imagine what it's like. I remember a man who never ate anything that was a carbohydrate in his life. He had a very strict wife who said, "We'll never eat carbohydrates." And one day he was sitting in a restaurant and somebody gave him a teaspoon of ice cream. And it was very cheap ice cream. It was like Breyer's ice cream or something. And he tasted it and he said, "This is the best ice cream I ever had." He said, "This is fantastic ice cream. Armand," he said, "you got to try this ice cream. There's no ice cream better than this." Because it was the only ice cream he ever had and he was ever allowed. I think with the borderline personality, life is hell. Mm. And when love comes along, love is like that ice cream that's in that life, you see. And so the taste of it is so enormous, so fantastic, that it really fills up all the empty holes for that little time. When you take that away, the rest of us settle for, and we have, a grown-up adult appreciation, love, caring, connection. But we can't love the way they do. We can't. Mm. We can't. And there's something about it that I think your patient is right. The attachment is terrific. Did you find your car dented that day?
My car was okay, thank you. But could I just comment on what you're saying now, because I think it's really important. And then we'll get back to fatal attraction. But this idea of only getting such a small taste of something, it gets to an issue we may have time to go on to further later. But, you know, what leads to this kind of state of being? And in a lot of cases, first of all, I don't think there's any one factor. Almost everyone who specializes in this agrees there are temperamental factors. That is, we're born with a certain nature, a certain reactivity, a certain emotionality. But there's also a mismatch with the environment, sort of one's needs not being responded to in the way that might be best. So usually patients who develop with this disorder have very little in terms of full gratification. So when they get a little bit of it, it's like your patient or your friend with the ice cream. It feels so good, but almost immediately after tasting it, they mistrust it because they're not used to it, and they're not sure it's real, and they might even attack it. And they're often testing to make sure it's the real thing, and it's the testing and challenging that can break the system down.
Break the system down, meaning break down the love system?
Yes.
In other words, you find a relationship, you're good in your relationship, you fall in love, and as soon as the person reciprocates, you might do something to test the relationship, and if they respond to that testing, you see if they pull away a little bit, if they just get angry in some kind of way, you then overreact back and say, "How could you pull away?" So in a way, it's creating this separation.
It's creating what's feared, because what's feared is the only thing you really believe is real.
The name of the book that was written about this is called "I Hate You, Don't Leave Me." It's probably the only book that's really out there that's very worthwhile, other than the one you're working on right now.
Well, I could name a couple of others, but I think "I Hate You, Don't Leave Me" is the classic book for the general public on this condition.
Yeah, and this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Part of what we do here is we try to get you to understand things. I think a Dr. Kreisman wrote, "I Hate You, Don't Leave
That's
Me."
That's correct.
Trying to get you to understand this about, you know, understanding love, understanding passion, understanding how people function, and you've seen it. You've seen deep emotionality, and we value it so much. We say, oh, let her have her feelings, you know, when people are outraged. And we're trying to understand a little more. Love relationships is one of the places where we see the person with the borderline personality disorder is the most dysfunctional. And again, we'll go to Marilyn Monroe, if that was her diagnosis, which I suspect it was. There she was, in love with a significant power figure who would have given her that identity that she needed, because she had no sense of self. She falls in love with John Kennedy. She has this power figure of a love of hers. She feels some sense of rejection. She reacts in some kind of a way. Now, I'm not saying she killed herself because of Kennedy, but the despair that followed her and everything that she did made her go into treatments where all they did was they wanted to just quell her, you know? Get quiet, here, take this pill, relax, reduce, get quieter.
Well, it's probably more complicated than that, because I think she did have an analysis at the time. But in those days, analysis was just beginning to learn about this condition. It's learned a lot, and analytic treatments can be very well tailored to this now. But in those days, they didn't have the modifications that people like Otto Kernberg have developed in the meantime. But you have to look at her in terms of a series of relationships. She had a series of these powerful men in her life, Joe DiMaggio, Arthur Miller, and they never worked out. Of course, we can't get into her mind. We don't know why they didn't work out. But generally, in a patient with this disorder, no matter how powerful the love object, no matter how suitable in many ways, they're not ideal. These people are looking for something ideal. There's something fundamentally romantic in a way about them. You can appreciate it emotionally, except it causes so much chaos and destruction.
You know, I would imagine that most men who ever loved Marilyn Monroe continued to love her after she was gone. You know, it's the nature of this disturbance, this personality characteristic is such that you see the powerlessness, the helplessness, and the childlikeness of the person who's caught in it. You may say to yourself, I can't live with it anymore, but I cherish you for all of your beauty, because you see the child that sits underneath this thing, you know. Now, this is just one form of this that we're talking about. Now, as we promised, let's go back to the Fatal Attraction.
All right. People probably remember that movie. It's from quite some time ago, but it left quite a strong impression. And Glenn Close played a character who was considered by many to be borderline. She was a single woman in Manhattan, and Michael Douglas had a brief fling with her while his wife and children were away, and then he wanted to say goodbye, and she started doing all sorts of things to keep him in her grip. She cut her wrists, and she, I can't remember all the details, she probably threatened to kill herself. She eventually invaded his home, kidnapped the children briefly, killed the pet rabbit. She really turned into a monster. So the unfortunate thing for those of us who really care about this disorder is that it gives some accurate details, and then it turns it into something totally exaggerated and unrealistic. And the thing that bothers me most about that movie is, if this were a real patient or person with the disorder, you can bet that she would be the one who's suffering the most. And in the movie, it looks like she's just gleefully enjoying torturing the people, Michael Douglas and his family. Having said that, there's a whole spectrum of borderline conditions. Some do have some sadistic elements, but they're very much the minority. And if you want to say that Glenn Close represented borderline with sadism tacked onto it, well, maybe. But I really am disturbed when people point to that movie as an example of a classic borderline.
However, Fatal Attraction, or the kind of attraction where you could fall in love with somebody at a distance, and you could have the kind of an attachment to somebody who may not in any way have given you any reason to believe that they really love you back. You know, they just may have said something in passing. It's common with people with borderline condition, isn't it?
Yeah, you're bringing us to a point which is really essential. I like to think of it in terms of the internal world and external reality. Borderline patients tend to live in relation to images they have in their minds, which they're not fully conscious of, but which determine how they see the world around them. And a big part of the therapy is helping them distinguish what's real from the internal images they impose on reality.
Give me an example of that, Frank.
Well, to use your example, say a borderline person sort of perceives a guy at a distance and decides it's the man of her life. Immediately, you've got what we call the projection of an internal image on a small element of external reality, but the individual believes that the way she sees this man is his reality. And then there's a whole process of, in normal life, a non-borderline individual would sort of reality check and see if what they imagined the person to be was, in fact, who the person is. But with a borderline person, the imposition of the internal image just sticks. Could I give you one example again from a patient? This was my first patient after I finished my training, and this is one of the people who got me interested in this disorder. And it's an example of how powerful these internal images are. This actually was a male patient. Only a minority of these patients are male. And he was kind of an angry guy. He alienated everybody in his life, as you said some people do. So he wasn't that easy to work with. But one day, in a session, he was telling me a story from his childhood that it was so sad it brought tears to my eyes, which is a little unusual for the therapist to do that, but what can you do? That was the situation. So he looked at me very quizzically, and he said, "You've got tears in your eyes." And I said, "Well, yes, that's the case." He thought for a minute. It looked like he was thinking very hard, and he then looked angrily at me and said, "You're mocking me." Mm. And I said to myself, that's such a powerful misperception. I couldn't imagine up to that point in my experience somebody who would take an element of reality and so convincingly to themselves turn it into the opposite. This is an example of how the internal perception or the internal image wins out over the external reality.
Yeah, I've seen it often enough. You know, radio hosts get a lot of that projection.
Do they?
Yes, you know, because nobody sees me.
True.
They hear my voice.
Yeah.
You know, and then that's it. It's just my voice and what they imagine behind it. Yeah. As people get with many people where they just have a little piece of the image, you know, I've seen it happen over and over again. It's what you have is an internal world projected on the external world. And I think you're saying something very important. You know, if the basic fundamental part of this disorder, we're talking about borderline personality disorder, if the fundamental bottom line of it is, I don't know who I am or what I am, I can't feel it. I just can't feel it. My emotions are so swift that I can't pin them down to anything, nor could I pin myself down. Therefore, what's left is I don't know what I am, so I'm going to make up things in my mind. I'm going to imagine things, and I'm going to tag the world with these things and somehow validate these things by what I see. So in other words, if I have a little paranoid thought about something, I'll validate it. I'll say, see, it's true. See, that person spoke to me nastily.
You know, it's interesting because you're describing a process that takes place, but you're describing it with awareness. The person who does it doesn't know they're doing it.
No, they don't, and they feel like victims.
Yeah.
And the victim part of this is like, you know, I mean, part of the time we look at people who feel like victims and we accuse them of being victims and we point our finger at them and say, look at you, you're acting like a victim, as if there's something wrong with them. But it's for us to understand that the people who feel like victims truly perceive the world that way.
I would add that the victim issue is complicated because in my experience, almost every borderline patient I've treated is a victim but also is an aggressor. They're two in one, if you will, and the two don't fit together. So it's true they're a victim, but they can also be aggressive in ways they're not aware of. So it's this combination that's logically inconsistent, but sort of is what they live out.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the alienation of the borderline personality with other people, people at work, people around them. This is Armand DeMille. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little soft music by Eric Reed, and then we'll be back. Rich, Eric Reed, my friends. Interesting way of playing piano. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind with Dr. Frank Yeomans. Here, talking about borderline personality disorder. This music by Eric Reed that we just switched to is I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good. A perfect theme song for what we're talking about, because it's just the way it feels. Don't you agree with this, Frank?
I agree fully. It's great. But I want to make sure, did we mention that this condition is treatable?
Well, we're going to talk about it as being more than treatable. It's also lovable. You know, it's like that's the part that most people don't get. You see, when a person is this highly emotive, when they're this emotive and a person is just kind of living with this kind of hellish life, you know, where they exploded people, they break up all their relationships with people. Usually they have people who refuse to talk to them anymore. You know, people get seduced by them, and then they have families that refuse to talk to them. Mm-hmm. They have, they lose their children in some kind of settlement. It's a life usually winds up just being a life of desperation, because they're being run by something on the inside that is so horrendous, it's like this cyclone inside you. One of the descriptions that I love that was in your in a CD that I saw, it said it's like being an emotional burn victim. It's like being somebody whose emotions are about on the surface the way pain would be to a person who is a burn victim. Because everything makes you react. Everything feels like you're just going to jump out of your skin on many levels. Not everything, but many things. So when you've got this, and what's happened in the past is a person with this kind of trouble alienates everybody. They don't have a job. They can't keep a job. They can't stay in school too well, with quite a few exceptions. Relationships are so chaotic that you have to have almost the most masochistic of person to be in relationship with them, you know, and or somebody who's a compulsive caretaker, you know, because they're taking care of this kind of person who's always in despair. So you have this kind of thing. You just don't know what to do. But now we found that this is curable, not only treatable, but curable, and not curable through medication. It's not the medication that it's curable through. It's the actual therapy itself. It's a talk process. It's a process of being in a room with somebody and learning how to be, and this is where the specialists in dealing with this do their real work. Medication, if at all, is very little.
Well, I want to emphasize the seriousness as you have, but I think we should also say that studies have shown about 10% of individuals with this disorder commit suicide, so it's a potentially lethal disorder. But the good news, as you said, is that treatments have been developed. The whole concept and understanding of the disorder started to take ground in the 60s and 70s, and since then a number of treatments have been established and are still being worked on. I think I should give a reference so people can call for or go
sure.
to a website for information. It's the BPD Resources Center. .org. That's one word, bpdresourcescenter.org. It has information, and we've tried to put together a database so that we would have resources where people might seek help throughout the country.
Now, what's also important about this is that most people with borderline personality disorder generally don't have the kind of job or money to find the treatment, and the BPD Resource Center helps people connect with treatment even if they don't have the money to pay for it.
We do our best. I wish I could say we could help everyone, but it's a terribly underfunded problem. There are people like you and I who are interested in this and our colleagues who specialize in this, but there aren't enough. So even people with money sometimes have a hard time getting specialized resources. And then you add financial constraints as well, and it's a real public health issue. So in this city, we're lucky to have clinics where people can go and get forms of specialized treatment. But even then, we have to look at treatment of symptoms versus the treatment of the disorder as a whole. In other words, treatment of people can stop the symptoms of cutting and burning themselves or the eating disorder, but sometimes they live with the same subjective misery just without the symptoms. And I would argue that we have to consider a full treatment, one where the person gets to live a life that has the same kind of satisfactions that you or I can hope to have in relationships or work.
Well, if you had your dreams, Frank, if you could set it up, if it, there could be the it doesn't have to be the Yeoman Center, but if it could be a treatment center that had was armed by, let's say, 20 clinicians who specialized in this and were paid a reasonable amount of money for their time and dedication, we would need a couple of $1 million to fund a program that could treat people, as many as 100 people a year.
I'm not doing the math right in my head, but that sounds realistic.
And I think we could start such a thing. I think we could look. You know, there's a couple of fundraisers around, like Marty Resnick, who's done so much good work in this world, can help, you know, put together a project where we could try to get some kind of funding to get the treatment there, because it's essential, because it is these very people, we're going to talk about the males, female population. In the male population in prisons, a good majority of them would be diagnosed with borderline personality disorder.
I don't have the statistics, but it's clear that in clinical settings, in medical treatment settings, the large majority of borderline patients are women. So people used to think, oh, there aren't as many borderline men as women. Turns out the men, instead of aggressing themselves as the women do, punch somebody else or attack somebody else. As you say, they wind up in prison. The prison population is rife with this disorder. Of course, some women with the disorder are in prison too. So there too it has to be addressed.
Well, when we talk about harming yourself, the women manifestation of the disorder very often will take in the form of hurting your own body, cutting yourself, being sexually promiscuous, doing risky behaviors, having things like that happen, having accidents, you know, auto accidents and stuff like that. That's one manifestation of it, is to hurt the body, almost as if the intention is to take the pain from outside, inside the body to the outside of the body, is the way some people have interpreted it.
Mm-hmm.
The male manifestation of the very same cyclone of energy is to act it out in a kind of ferocious way, is the tendency. And therefore you see men who will be aggressive spontaneously in the world. Now, what happens when you take a group of men with borderline personality disorder and you put them in the same setting and you put 30 of them in the same room? You know, they learn control. I mean, it's a thing happens to you where you wind up controlling. It's its own therapy, isn't it?
I thought you were going to say the opposite. I thought you were going to say you put 30 men like this in a room together and it's chaos. And
but it's not, because the prisons are controlled.
I'm not an expert on the prisons, but I thought there was a lot of difficult, problematic behavior in that setting. So
there are a lot of difficult, but even within the setting, there is a certain amount of it, even with your peers, that this effort of control is put into force. And this brings me to why you could do the treatment you do.
Yeah.
Because when somebody comes into your office who is seemingly out of control, you're betting that they also have available to them a part of them that is capable of the control. When we use the prison as an example, the consequences for acting out in prison, when you have a bunch of peers who could bop you over the head or put a knife in you if you act out, when you have severe consequences, it inhibits even your most violent impulses in many ways. But in the outside world in general, when you have these impulses, there's very little that helps you control your impulses. You just want to scream them out. Now, they go to your office, and they get treatment from you or from a variety of the different forms of treatments that are used for borderline personality disorder, and you teach them control.
Well, yeah. Let me talk about the hospital setting.
Sure.
I'm more familiar with that than the prison setting. But also I want to pick up on a term you used, acting out. You say these people are acting out. Now, in plain English, the term to act out has taken on the meaning to misbehave, but it actually has a formal meaning in psychiatry. It means to act out the emotion you can't tolerate feeling. So it's really important to realize these people experience things. As soon as they get a hint of it in their awareness, they act it out because it's too powerful to experience. Our belief is that with help, they can be brought into touch with these emotions. They can get to know them. They can learn them, and they can modulate them so that they're no longer victim of them. They're no longer mastered by the emotion, but they become masters of the emotion. But to get back to the hospital...
Well, while you're in it, let's talk about actually doing that with someone. Give me an example of someone who walks in to see you and says, "Hey, I have this... I have this incredible rage. I'm sitting here and I can't even sit here. Your secretary kept me waiting 5 minutes before I got here, and I got here 3 minutes early. So now I'm angry at you too, and you're just like the rest of them." How do you help me?
I'll modify your example a little bit, because the anger is at me, not at the secretary. Patient walked in, and I do a modified form of a psychoanalytic therapy, so I maintain what we call neutrality. I like to explore everything before I act on it. Patient asked if she could borrow a book from my bookshelf. I said, that's an interesting request. First time you've asked me for something, I wonder what that might mean. And she said, "You, excuse my language, son of a bitch," and so on and so forth. "You're just like the rest of them. You wouldn't give me the time of day. You want me to fail." And she got up out of her chair. She was pacing back and forth, yelling and screaming at me, and menacingly with a can of Coke like she was going to throw it at me. So I just said, "Do you think you could stop so we can observe this for a moment?" And she did. She had enough what we call observing ego, or if you just want to call it rational thought at the moment, to stop and think. I said, "You're telling me I'm mistreating you, I'm treating you horribly, but suppose someone were to walk by and look in through this window, what would they see?" And she thought for me, she said, "They think I was being pretty awful to you." And I said, "Yeah, the only problem was you weren't at all aware of that." Now, I'm not against anger and aggression, I told her, because everybody has them, but you were being very angry and aggressive without a clue, because it was just coming out through your actions. If you're angry at me, that's fine, but how about getting a grip on it, and then you can use it better, and you'll be more convincing, you won't be so torn up by it, and you'll be more effective in getting what you want from me.
The person's experience at first is to throw the can of Coke, to stand up. The impulse, the way it hits you, the way it touches you, is almost as if you made the plan beforehand. I'm going to go for this book. I know I shouldn't ask for this book. I'm going to ask for this book. You're going to react to it. You're going to deny me. I'm going to get angry at you for denying me. This is not all conscious. This is all unconscious. Then I'm going to rage at you, and then I'm going to be able to throw you away as I throw away everybody else. I'm going to reject you. But don't reject me.
It gets back to what I was talking about what their familiar territory is. They're comfortable in a world where people disappoint them and fail them. Somebody's nice to them, they begin to get suspicious. It's just not something they're so used to. So I would agree with your scenario. It probably does develop that way. There probably is something unconscious pushing to feel rejected. So it confirms their negative view of the world. So they have the sadness that they have the sadness that the world is a negative place, but they have the reassurance that they know the score.
So this is Armand DeMille. We're talking about this now. Now, when we talk about you, talking about men versus women, if we saw it originally as 90% women, 10% men, and part of course, the analysis by men was that since women are hormonal and therefore emotional, it is therefore a woman's disease. Right? Is one of the ways that we kept women down and objectified them.
Yeah.
But if we do a survey across country, it comes out about 50-50.
The last survey of the general population I saw, I think it was 50-50,
50% men, 50% women, with the 50% men who we see with borderline personality disorder, possibly even nowadays being homeless, hospitalized, or in prisons, with the ones who can't function. And it's like, you can use that shield of anger and non-attachment and attachment at the same time. It's kind of amazing to see somebody who's in the streets who could be so angry and so attached to their belongings, which could be nothing. It could be a small box. And, you know, they could be so rightfully attached to it, and then they could just rage at you all the time, just be living in that kind of thing. And there's no attention, and there's no way of treating it, and there's no way of helping it. Can we put together a way of doing this, of bringing help to this? And that's where we're hoping to start. That's part of the seed today. We are looking to somehow fund the research and the treatment. The research has been enough. I want to use these few minutes, Frank, if you don't mind, to talk about when people think about borderline, they think about the angry borderline.
Yeah.
There are five different degrees of it that we've isolated or kind of...
Well, I would say there are a number of degrees. First of all, when you say the research is enough, I think we need a lot more research, but I'll just say that in passing.
Yeah, we have a lot of research,
but
we have very little treatment.
We need more research, too, but they go hand in hand. In terms of the different subtypes, there aren't official subtypes, but people who specialize tend to see a number of the following. For instance, there are those who are more depressive and passive, and there's another group that's sort of more aggressive and angry. Then there are those who are more narcissistic and who tend to treat others as objects of exploitation rather than entering into more mutual dependent relationships. And on the far extreme, there are people with antisocial tendencies who tend to be dishonest and often get involved in criminal behaviors or the kind of antisocial behaviors that really hurt and exploit other people. So, just off the top of my head, I would say the depressives, the aggressives, the narcissistics, the antisocials. I'm probably leaving out some other subtypes.
Where would paranoia fit in with this?
I think paranoia gets more intense as you go down that list I just gave you. But I think paranoia is in at least some small fashion part of most borderline's experience. It's this mistrust of what you're offering. This idea that if they scratch beneath the surface or push you far enough, you'll reject them. And it keeps them from getting close to people. So often people, non-borderline people, are very confused. They offer what seems to be a good deal to someone, a nice relationship, and they're treated very angrily and aggressively. It's because of that paranoia that there must be something behind what you're offering. You want to use me. You want to hurt me. A lot of these people have been hurt severely in their early development. So, you know, there's some logic to the way they feel.
And even in their adult, if you're fragile and attractive, you know, you're going to be exploited.
Interestingly, though, one of our colleagues, Michael Stone, did a study of 500 of these patients. He found that being attractive was a good prognostic factor in treatment.
Well, isn't being attractive always there?
That's true.
A good prognostic. What was it? Yavis syndrome.
Yeah,
syndrome was young, attractive, verbal, intelligent, and successful.
True enough.
Generally, he's going to do better in therapy than anybody else.
Yeah.
The next stage of research, if you could have it, what would it be? What would you like to see?
Well, for me, the next stage of research, first, I'll say two things, would be about stages of change, because I think most of the research to date has been about remission of symptoms, but not really the resolution of the core identity problem.
Well, let's get this clear. You believe that this is not about remission of symptoms. If we're going to treat it, let's fix it.
Well, in an ideal world.
In
the real world, remission of symptoms is already pretty good. The problem
What remission of symptoms means to people listening, it means that you still have the illness, but the symptoms go away. They go in hiding somewhere for a little while.
You're not cutting yourself. You're not drinking, for example. You're not getting into fights all the time with people. But internally, you feel very unhappy. You're not clear on who you are, and life is still pretty dismal for you.
That's the remission.
Yeah.
Being done with this, what changes? How does it change?
How do you get beyond that remission?
Yeah.
I think you get beyond that remission by putting your identity together, by getting to know all the different parts of yourself that are all fragmented and a lot of them beyond your awareness, and putting them into a sort of coherent whole, beginning to realize that you can stand in your own right as a respectable person. You can have mutual dependency with other people. Because as you said earlier, a lot of borderline patients don't have any decent sense of self-esteem. So that's why the other becomes so important. All your worth is in how the other regards you. You begin to develop your own self-regard. You begin to develop a full knowledge of who you are and to believe that that counts.
That's amazing. So we're looking to work. We're looking to find more more stuff, and the research would be on the treatment that would result in.
Yeah, I would also, besides research on different stages of treatments, because I think we've sort of mushed the research into treatment as though it's not in separate stages, I think we should have more research on the subtypes. We're beginning to do that. But it seems clear to me that it's a very broad category, and there are different types within it. Some types may respond more to one treatment and some to other.
And by treatments, you know, I want you to understand that although Frank Yeomans is a psychiatrist, he's a psychiatrist who believes that the treatment is a therapeutic treatment, not a medication treatment. Medication is used barely, right?
Well, I wouldn't say barely. I think medication, I would say it's used as a help, as an auxiliary help. I would mention at least a number of treatments just in passing. The one I do myself is called transference-focused therapy. It's based on a psychoanalytic model. But dialectic behavioral therapy is very popular, and it's very good, I think, especially in the first stage we've been talking about, with skills training modules. There's also mentalization-based therapy, which is coming out of England, and there are a few others. But medication can help tone down the symptoms and allow you to do the work in therapy.
So often you can be so filled with emotions.
Exactly.
That you just can't do anything. You can't can't read a book.
Yeah.
You know, can't do anything. So the medication helps. I want to thank you very much for being with us. My guest, Dr. Frank Yeomans, the www.bpdresource.
Yeah, no, www.bpdresourcecenter.org.
Resourcecenter.org.
Yeah.
And if you want to get that, we will set up a link with the Positive Mind if you don't get it directly. And thank you very much for being
with us. It's
been
my pleasure.
You're going to come back, and the two of us will proudly talk about narcissism.
Very proudly.
Very proudly. We will be back with you. Listen, just for your information, I'll be back with you tomorrow with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to be talking about some very interesting stuff. The nature of will. We're going to talk about what is will, you know, what is it all about, what makes your will happen. And then also, you know, keep in mind Thursday you might set your clock, because at 12 o'clock Roberta Atti is going to have her pilot program on. She's going to be talking about time on WBAI. So then on Thursday you get Roberta first at 12 o'clock and the Positive Mind at 1 o'clock following that. This is Armand DeMille. I am looking forward to that program we're doing with Majid Ali on the 26th. We're going to have a three-hour program from 11 to 2. I should be amazing as well. He's a remarkable man. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. For a copy of today's program, or you want to hear it replayed, go to thepositivemind.com.